I will call the House Senate Tax Conference Committee to order. We have a couple things we need to take care of for housekeeping right now. I believe Senator Rest has an amendment that changes some things in the domicile for board members. And I believe that's the same language in the House and the Senate. Mr. Michael, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Both the House and the Senate have this have identical provisions with identical effective dates.
Okay, so when we get the amendment, maybe Chair Resman, you could describe the amendment a little bit.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A42 eliminates the retroactive feature of the effective date, which was causing our spreadsheet to be out of balance. And we are requesting, further than that, a review of the revenue estimate period. But one of the things we do know is that the retroactive date would cause the revenue estimate for the current year to put our spreadsheets out of balance. And so I believe it's pretty simple language, but I believe it's pretty clear what to do. And our staffs have communicated, and you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Scoy have communicated. And so I would move the A42.
Okay. Chair Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The revenue estimate came after the bill has passed off the floor of the Senate, so we need to adopt this in order to get the bill to line up with the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what happened was originally was unknown. This is unknown, and then it came in and put us out of balance. So discussion from members. Then we'll go to the department. Any comments from Commissioner Bauer or Mr. Cummings?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and Senator Rest. We appreciate the clarification on the effective year. Frankly, it's always easier for us to administer going forward than retroactive. It's much easier for taxpayers and for the department. As we noted in the administrative memo, there are some other issues with administrability we would like to continue discussing with the committee with respect to some definitional issues so that we can administer it pursuant to your intent. So we'd like to continue having those. And we actually have some draft language we'd like to share with you in the next 24 hours, if that's possible.
Questions from comments? Chair Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. That's all well and good, but what we really need to do right now is correct the spreadsheets for both bodies. So that's this is nothing to do with policy, only to do with, or the administering, only to do with the getting balance in the spreadsheets.
This issue will be visited further. So Senator Rest moves the SCH 084842 amendment. Hearing none, all favors say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Rest.
I wonder if Senate Fiscal could identify the page on this on the side by side, or maybe Ms. Pollack, the page on the side by side that this is amending, and we actually amended the Senate language. So we're not taking the provision. We just amended and adopted the Senate provision with regard to the effective dates. Understand what I mean? Even though it's the same, it's a money item, so we're not taking that one.
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair and members, the reference is on page 13 of the side-by-side. It's House Article 1, Section 35, Senate Article 1, Section 25.
Did you get that, Chair Rest?
No, I'm looking right now.
Ms. Pollack, let's try that again.
Mr. Chair and members, the reference to this provision is on page 13 of the side-by-side at the very bottom, House Article 1, Section 35, Senate Article 1, Section 25.
Chair Rest?
Yes,
okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, with that, members, we have an agenda for some items to go over from the House bill itself. And then the Senate also has a list that we'll be looking at. I believe Chair Escoy will be taking that up tomorrow on that. And then, members, of course, as soon as we get numbers, we will be having a bit more robust meetings as we work to put the bill together. Okay, so with that, estate tax provisions on the side-by-side, page 28. If I could, who would handle that from House Research? Mr. Michael, could you please join us?
Yeah.
Chair Escoy?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the members would think about this, but, you know, we just adopted an amendment to get some language in the shape that we needed it for a spreadsheet and for the conference committee. Clearly nothing to do with the acceptance of the provision. But what I'd like to talk about, or just maybe not now, but maybe later today, if you have language changes that you'd like to make to provisions that you're presenting, they're clarifying amendments, you know, I would hope that you'd offer them. We'd get the language in the order that the body wants it in. Then we can have the conversation about whether we'd be adopting those provisions or not. But it might help the staff. If we know of changes to language, if we would make them as we're presenting provisions or as we have further conversation about them. And then the language would be in the order that the body would want.
I think that's a very good idea. Members, anything that you would have that we need to work on, items we have before us, so I think that's a very good suggestion. Okay, so the items we'll go through today, we have three estate tax provisions in the House bill. If Mr. Michael could present those to the conference committee, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this appears on page 28 of the side-by-side. And essentially what the House bill does, there are three or four different components, but fundamentally the change that's being made is that the exclusion amount, which under, or the, actually it's a zero bracket amount is probably the more accurate way to describe it. Under current law is set at $1.4 million for individuals who die in 2015, and that increases by $200,000 a year until it reaches $2 million under current law. What the House bill does is to increase that instead by $1 million steps. So it would increase, instead of to $2 million by 2018, it would increase to $5 million. And in the year after that, it would increase to the federal exclusion amount, which is an amount that's indexed for inflation and is currently $5,000,043. So that's the first component. The second component is that the rate brackets are adjusted with each of those steps, taking away the lower brackets, so that as the exemption goes up, the lower rate brackets go away, which offsets a little bit of the benefit of the increase in the exemption. And mitigates the revenue loss somewhat. In addition, the filing requirements are obviously adjusted to reflect the higher zero bracket amount. And then finally, once the exclusion is equal to the federal exclusion, the ability to have a Minnesota Q-tip, a qualified terminable interest property, that differs from the federal is eliminated, because the primary reason for doing that is to allow Minnesota estates the planning flexibility of planning for the fact that we have a different exclusion than the federal exclusion. So that's a summary of the estate tax provisions that are in the House bill.
Thank you. And then you'll also notice that the third one there is in the Senate bill, which is the Eminent Domain Repatriated Recapture Tax. We talked about that a little bit the other day. There's Eminent Domain used or could be used because you want to build a hospital, a football field, take part of the farm. They're not kicked out of the current state. But I guess that's the Senate provision. Okay, so those are the two House versions. Questions? Chair Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Michaels. So what is the rates? What are the rates when this is fully implemented? And then does the House proposal pick up and match the federal inflator, or what is the deal?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, yes, the essentially for deaths, let me make sure about this, it's 2019 and later, yet the amount of the Minnesota exclusion would equal the federal exclusion, which is indexed for inflation, and so it would, as the federal exclusion amount goes up, the Minnesota zero bracket amount would go up in step with that.
And I didn't catch the rate at that point.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yes, the rates now range from 9% to 16%, and as I indicated, those lower bracket rates go away with each step. So by 2018, it would just be a flat 16%, and that would, of course, not change for 2019 and later. The other point, I guess, that I should make, which I didn't, is that by going to the federal amount, the House bill also adopts the what's called frequently portability. So if you have a married couple that owns property, the federal government in 2012 adopted this portability provision, which allows the surviving spouse to inherit the portion of the exclusion amount that's not used by on the death of the first spouse. Previous to that, and under Minnesota law now, in order to make sure that you don't waste your exclusion amount, you have to essentially set up typically a two-trust arrangement and divide assets between the spouses. Otherwise, you run the risk if the spouse that doesn't own property dies first, that spouse will not, and the married couple will not benefit from the exclusion. The federal system essentially allows you to pass, when the first spouse dies, to pass that unused exclusion amount on. And by conforming or allowing a subtraction for the amount of the federal exclusion, the House bill picks that up. Now, the one little quirk in that that's worth noting is that unused spousal exclusion gets drawn down by lifetime gifts. And so that's the one feature of this where, because that's the way the federal law works, the federal law has a gift tax. If the married couple makes lifetime gifts and uses up their federal exclusion, that would also use up the deceased spouse unused exclusion amount. It wouldn't affect the basic exclusion amount, but it would affect that carryover amount.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael, so that's the portability component that you're picking up there.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair, perhaps, I don't know who it is, I'm looking at page 6, line 157. Is that the cost of? I'm looking at page 6, line 157. Is that the cost of this provision? $60 million.
Yeah.
On the spreadsheet, $60 million.
Six. Here we should go to Ms. Templin. Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, the cost of the estate tax provision in the House bill are found on page 6 on line 157. And it is $60.5 million in the fiscal 16-17 biennium and $123 million in the second biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Templin, is the provision fully implemented by the 18-19 biennium?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking toward Joel, or Mr. Michael. There, I believe it is mostly, if not fully, phased in by the fourth year, by fiscal 19.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, there's one more year to pick up the full cost of it, so it doesn't totally show in that fourth year.
Okay.
Chair's fine.
Thank you. That's good.
Senator Gazelka?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, does portability begin right away then?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, no, it does not. It does not actually begin until 2019, so that's one of the problems with this, that individuals would not be able to rely on it until that happens.
Thank you.
Senator Gazelka. Any other questions on to the department, Commissioner Bartle?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. As we had previously testified before the House, in hearing this provision, by phasing in the elimination over 5 years, the long-term costs of this proposal are not covered in this window. So once it is fully phased in, it will cost the state over $170 million a biennium. And, of course, it is attached to the federal amount, which includes an index, so it will go up over time. And while we understand that there is significant interest in this provision, we are concerned that this is a significant sum of the state's revenue that would be allocated to not very many particular estates. We do also understand the interest in ag land values and the changes that were made in 2011 and the phase-in of the additional exclusion amount in 2013 for other estates. We think current law is sufficient to cover the needs of Minnesota. We understand that ag land values are a constant source of concern and that ag land values are very high, and so the small business and qualified farm deductions that were passed in 2011 do allow Minnesota families to have this relief for their farms and small businesses to allow them to be passed on. And our administration of that particular provision that was passed in 2011, we see at this point in time about 300 estates claiming the qualified small business and farm property subtraction per year, and fewer than 10 estates annually claim the maximum subtraction, meaning fewer than 10 are paying the estate tax each year under existing law. The current proposal, as Mr. Michaels noted, also doesn't quite get Minnesota into federal conformity, and so we'd like to note that that lack of federal conformity is a challenge for Minnesota taxpayers. And if the decision is made to fully conform to the federal estate tax, the department would recommend considering that Minnesota find true conformity by following the federal exemption and rules. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Powerly, I'm thinking about, you know, when we figure out these bills, we have dynamic scoring, so we don't really calculate ramifications of what we do. Do you guys have any analytics or ways that you can track people that are leaving to avoid the fact that our estate taxes are quite a bit, they're not as good as some of the other states? Because at the end of the day, you know, we're not calculating the people that we get nothing on because they're smart enough to go somewhere else. And so I'm just wondering what you guys do for that.
Sure.
Commissioner Barley?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, there's a lot of research surrounding why people move, and the social science research says that certainly we acknowledge that taxes may be one reason that people do move, but primarily people move because of jobs and family, and I would suggest in Minnesota it might be the weather. So there's a lot of research out there that says that taxes are not the reason. I believe the state demographer did a report earlier this year about the numbers of people leaving and coming and going to Minnesota and their age ranges and other demographic information. We obviously at the department can only gather aggregate data on people who are actually filing taxes, and so we don't have information about who would not be filing taxes. Although I would note that the revenue estimates, obviously, our research team is made up of incredibly smart and talented economists, and they are able to extrapolate based on data some of the assumptions, and they describe those for you in any revenue estimate.
Okay. Senator Gazelka.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner Bowerly, I'm thinking about the folks that are, they're typically over 65. It is not about a job. They've built up their wealth, and now they're trying to figure out the best way to get it to their family, and that's a different group. And I live in an area that has some of the Twin Cities folks that have their cabin on Gull Lake, and I know personally and some of those that have done just what I'm talking about, where they've positioned themselves to be in Florida or somewhere else so that they can avoid this. And that's why I asked the question is I don't want to lose people unnecessarily, and I didn't know if you guys had any way of tracking that, but I, if you don't, I would encourage us to be seriously looking at that.
Okay. Commissioner Bauerly. Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, the data that we would have right now is some of the data that I mentioned about who is actually claiming the exemptions, and if you'd like some updated information on that, not focusing on the small business, I could try to provide that for you.
I would. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions on the estate tax portion? Okay. Before we go on to the research credit, staff has brought to me an amendment that we do need because the rest amendment was basically for the Senate.
And I'm happy to move that.
And, okay, Senator Ress moves H0848A100, and it is not exactly the same as the Senate's. I think we're 1 year off, and we'll figure that out later. Just we want
to
get our numbers.
Yes. So
I'm
happy to move the
A100. Okay. Senator Ress moves the A100 amendment. Any discussion? Ms. Templin, this does it for us here. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Rest. Okay, item next, research credit. Is that Mr. Michael?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I share it with Ms. Manzi, but since I'm here, I'll.
Ms. Manzi, you want to join us too? Or something I said? Or? Okay. Mr. Michael and members, we're on the research credit.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is here's on page 10-11 of the side-by-side summary. It starts on section 25 near the bottom of the page. There are three different changes that are made in the credit under the House bill. The first provision is that it extends it to sole proprietors, and that the Senate bill also does this, so they're the same on that feature. Under current law, individuals who have pass-through entities are allowed the credit, but not sole proprietors, including individuals who have disregarded LLCs. So that's the first change it makes, and then also it, in that same section, the House bill, remember that the research and development credit is a two-tiered credit. There's a first tier on the first $2 million of qualified research. It's a 10% credit. And on research that's over that, it's a 2.5% credit. The House bill increases that second tier, the 2.5%, to 4%. That's effective a year later for tax year 2016. The third change that's made is that the first tier of the credit under the House bill is made refundable, so individuals that have either no liability or less than enough liability to use up the full research credit would be allowed a refund up to a maximum of $200,000. The Senate provision has a similar refundability, but there is this cap at $15,000. As part of the, if you turn the side-by-side to page 11, the last part of the sole proprietor provision is that when this was in the House and Senate tax bills last conference committee, concerns were expressed by the Department of Revenue about administration of the sole proprietor portion of this, and so both bills have a pre-certification requirement. The House bill has the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development making that certification. Would be done by the taxpayers would apply to deed for pre-certification by September 15th. And then would file amended returns for that tax year. The Senate bill is different in that it relies on the Department of Revenue to do the pre-certification, and it does not have this mechanism where you file amended returns. And the spreadsheet provisions are on lines 10 through 14, which I believe are on page 2. load the spreadsheet.
Hey, questions from members? The department? Commissioner Bowerly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We appreciate the consideration for the department's administrability concerns with respect to this credit, and we have a lot of experience with this area. The certification requirement, we still have some concerns with. First, with respect to the certification that is done with deed, the Department of Revenue may still need to access that application because it may include important information as we ensure that this credit is being taken by the entities that you all intend them to be taken by. We appreciate that the Senate language does have the Department of Revenue certifying those applications. However, we're not sure, we are concerned that 60 days may not quite be enough for us to be able to complete that work as you would intend. We know that this credit was refundable for a short period of time in 2010 and 2012, and in the department's experience administering that law change, we had some challenges, frankly. We need to make sure that we can educate these taxpayers, particularly if this is expanded to sole proprietors, and then we need to make sure that we can review those claims for refund to ensure statutory compliance and other efforts to ensure proper administration. An alternative that the department has provided would add some additional criteria to try to make sure that this group of people that are receiving the credit are those that you all intend, and that would include having the claimant have at least 3 employees, a total of at least $50,000 in payroll, and business expenses totaling at least $250,000 the year that the credit is claimed. We'd appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this. And another issue that we would also like to continue discussing is how this credit should be spread across tiers and whether the first tier is or the second tier is the appropriate place to make this expansion. And finally, in our experience with administering this credit, we know that many of these claims are not prepared by the taxpayers themselves, but rather by outside individuals. And sometimes these are actually done on sort of a on a contingency fee. The lawyer in me gapped on contingency fee. And so what happens is that if it turns out that that claim is inaccurate and does not qualify under the law, the taxpayer is actually on the hook for returning that credit and not the person who may have helped them prepare that or have done the analysis for that preparation. And so we have also offered you some language to consider that would help that to make sure that the person who's actually doing that calculation or helping that taxpayer prepare that return is also on the hook, if you will, for being accurate. Because at the end of the day, the department has to administer these provisions according with the law that you all pass. And if the taxpayer or their preparer was wrong, often that preparation or the person who has done those calculations is long gone and the taxpayer is left needing to pay the bill on the refund. So we look forward to working with you as we continue to move forward on this provision.
Other questions from members on the research credit? Chair Squire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Commissioner, I think we agree that having the preparer sign off on those is a good provision. I have a little question about the narrowing up of the criteria for the sole proprietor. 3 employees, $50,000, just kind of your recommendation. We've thought that being that the department was certifying these kind of pre-credit, that would cover the issue of these smaller businesses with 1 or 2 people, you know, and wondering what your reaction is to not narrowing those provisions up and letting the certification process of DOR do some of that, ensuring that they're actually doing the research. I just think that, you know, why would we have these size conditions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chairman Skoy. I think if we could help clarify what maybe we could look at some additional language for what the certification would require. We would just want to make sure that we are not only issuing a certificate that would allow the individuals that you intend to receive it, but then on the other end, also make sure that they are staying in compliance with whatever those criteria might be, and that these are really the types of individuals that you are intending to receive the credit that they are. So we can certainly, if the criteria that we've identified are insufficient, we can certainly look at other ways of trying to do that.
Well, and then could you just repeat? I didn't quite catch all the – you had some questions about Tier 1, Tier 2. If you could repeat that, I didn't catch it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chair Skoy. My comment was about the increased rate for Tier 2, and I think we just want to continue the conversation about who – this is obviously incentivizing certain sizes and certain types of companies, and if the second tier is the place to increase that credit rate, or if the first tier would be an alternative place to increase that credit rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions from members? Okay, let's go to the next item, tobacco. Who is covering tobacco? Simon? Thank you, Mr. Michael. Okay, tobacco provisions in the House. Mr. Planner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are three essentially provisions relating to tobacco taxation in the House bill. The first one and starts, this would be page 53 of the side-by-side, sections 5 through 7 and 9 through 13. And those sections relate to the vapor products taxation provisions. Currently, vapor products are taxed at a rate of 95% of the wholesale price of the vapor product. In essence, what the vapor products provisions in the House bill do is they would impose instead a rate of 30 cents per milliliter of what's called and what is defined as consumable material on vapor products. Consumable material is essentially the e-liquid or the nicotine solution that's used in vapor products, and that's used as the vapor product is used. Moving on, the next provision, this is also on page 53 and also 54. This provision would repeal the inflation indexing on the cigarette excise tax. Currently, the cigarette excise tax on a pack of cigarettes is $2.90, and these provisions would also permanently set the excise tax on a pack of cigarettes at the current rate of $2.90. The last provision has to do with the sale of cigarette tax stamps, and two main things that the bill would do with regard to tax stamps is that it would provide for the sale of those tax stamps to distributors at a 0.45% discount. In addition, right now under current law, the Department of Revenue has to recover the costs of actually making the tax stamps from the distributor they sell the stamps to, and the bill would eliminate that requirement to recover the costs of the stamps when they're sold.
Okay, thank you. Questions for members on the tobacco section?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, who's going to be the winner and losers under the vaping changes? I just want you to kind of walk us through that to make sure I get it.
Sure. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka. I think the best way to look at the shift in the tax burden from current law to the proposed 30-cent per milliliter law is to look at the what happens to the tax rate per milliliter of nicotine solution from the current rate at 95% of wholesale to what it would be under 30 cents per milliliter. For vapor products, so for instance, containers of e-liquid, and these are rough back-of-the-envelope numbers, but at 31 cents per milliliter or less for nicotine solution, those vapor products that sell that currently have a tax imposed at that rate would see a tax increase. The percentage tax increase would increase as we approach zero under the current rate. For those vapor products that are end up currently being taxed at 32 cents per milliliter of nicotine solution under the 95% of OTP or other tobacco products tax rate, you would see a tax decrease on those products, which again gets larger as a percentage as that that 32 cents number goes higher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we'll stay on the vaping and then go to the other questions. So I'm understanding that the proposal is to go away from the 95% to 30 cents per milliliter of material that has nicotine in it that's consumable. Is there a percentage of nicotine in the liquid, or is it all very standardized, or how do we determine what that is?
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, there e-liquid is sold at a variety of different levels of nicotine concentration, but that the proposed 30 cent per milliliter tax is not based on nicotine concentration. Although, you know, at retail you'll see containers of e-liquid selling for, you know, they'll say they'll have a certain expressed in milligrams, they'll have a certain, they'll contain an indication of the amount of nicotine that's actually in the e-liquid.
So, Mr. Chair, so the percentage of nicotine isn't part of the calculation. If current law is somebody buys a large container of this material, they pay 95% of the wholesale tax on the large container?
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, that's correct. The 95% of wholesale rate would be applied to that bulk purchase of nicotine solution, I believe at the time that that would be imported into the state.
And, Mr. Chair, because I'm not familiar with these products, what kind of tax is on that, and how does that distribute down to the user per time that they vape? I guess you don't smoke them, but vape.
Mr. Klayman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, I'm just not familiar enough with wholesale prices of bulk nicotine solution. However, you can purchase 100% nicotine solution, which is not certainly not consumable in that form, and it would have to be diluted. I'm not sure the extent to which it can be diluted, but it would certainly have to be diluted quite a bit before it could be sold to a consumer as e-liquid in a way that would be safe for that vapor to then use that in a vapor product.
And, Mr. Chair, we didn't hear this, so we're hearing these for the first time now. So we don't really know what the per milliliter tax is now to compare it to the 30 cents. So we'll maybe we can get some information on that. I don't know. Maybe we'll just have to get a little more data there. You guys heard this. Was there testimony about what the change was going to be impacting for people?
Yes, had the testimony from several sources that actually come in from out of state to explain okay. What was going on there, so we could have testimony on it.
Okay.
Senator Dietzick, is that right? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that, you know, what is a milliliter equivalent? Is that, you know, when they're doing the vaping and they've got the milliliter in here and I've got a whole bunch of graphs and stuff, is that a cigarette? Is that a pack of cigarettes? I'm just trying to get in my head, you know, what would 30 cents a milliliter be, and then how does that compare to the current tax on, like, a cigarette and a pack of cigarette, just as we, you know, comparison. And then my other questions on, I have the summary of your and Senator Coonan's bill, and was just curious, and also in here, did you include that the tax would no longer apply to the promotional distribution of e-cigarettes and vapor products, or was that removed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, the provisions that exempted vapor products from not being distributed promotionally is removed in the
okay.
version that's in the omnibus okay. tax bill.
Thank you. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just note that I don't know what word I should use, adverb I should use, but surprisingly, this provision in your bill is one that I have gotten any number, and the most objection to from my constituents as seeing it as a, describing it as a provision that is supported by big tobacco and that is against those, and this is their words, okay, not mine, against those that are trying to quit smoking and use the vaping products, and that for those constituents, for those people, it is it would be a huge tax increase. They don't like what we did before because Minnesota was one of the, well, almost an outlier to start with in passing the tax on vaping, and then it remains an outlier now, and their claim is that this would make it even worse for them. And I don't have any way of judging their complaint, but I hear it over and over and over again. So just to communicate that to you.
Thank you. Questions from members?
Certainly, Chair Skoy.
Just on the tax stamp provision, I'm not familiar with this. Is this an effort to reimburse the marketers for the costs of applying the stamps onto the packages, or is that what the purpose of that is?
Yes, and I think we did it till about, I think they were reimbursed, help me out, until about 2005. And I think we stopped reimbursing them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, I believe it was either 2003 or 2005, but yeah, there was a provision on the books that had a discount of, I believe, 1% for the first $1.5 million in sales of cigarette tax stamps.
Senator Scully?
And Mr. Chair, so this is 0.45% of the tax, if I can do the math on that.
Mr. Thaman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scully, to be 0.45% of the face value of the stamp, excluding the portion of that face value that's attributable to the cigarette sales tax.
Maybe to save me doing the math, could you tell me what that is?
Mr. Thaman, what is that?
So it would be 0.45% of the $2.90 excise tax, and then I'd have to do the math.
We'll
I'm sorry,
it.
I don't have that. Maybe does fiscal staff? I don't. They might have
about a dollar
Michelle?
And a half. About a dollar and a half.
Dollar and a half.
Yeah.
Dollar and a half a pack.
That doesn't sound right.
That doesn't sound right.
0.45%.
It's a penny.
0.45 times 2.9.
It's a penny.
$1.30.
Michelle?
It's a penny and a quarter. 0.3 cents per.
You don't have to move.
Move the decimal. Yeah. 0.0045.
So move the decimal twice.
0.0045.
Yeah, it's 0.013.
Penny and a third.
Yep.
What a deal.
Yeah, what a deal.
Okay. To the department, any other questions from members? Before I go to the department, then we can come back to questions from members. To the department on the tobacco provisions in the House bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And if I could start in, if you might allow me to start in reverse order with respect to the stamp reimbursement, the department would request an allocation of $200,000 because the department does have to buy the stamps and pay the supplier of the stamps, and so this would result in essentially a loss to us, and so we would need the funds to be able to continue that administering that program. And that's the fund that would be a biennial number. It's a little over $100,000 a year for the stamps. That's what we would lose in this under this provision. With respect to vapor products, I think the discussion here today so far has helped demonstrate that this is an emerging market, and there's a lot of questions. And our system in Minnesota statutory system is based on distributing and selling at retail tobacco products, and this essentially is more like manufacturing, and for good reason. We don't have a system that deals with manufacturing tobacco products because we don't grow tobacco here, and so this raises a lot of questions about how to fit this kind of new product into the existing tax system. And as Chair Skoy noted, these larger, perhaps a gallon jug of nicotine solution would need to be diluted to be used by a human, and that we understand that that is about a 2.4% solution that is ultimately used in a vaping system. And there are refillable systems and closed systems in the marketplace, and so those would also need to be accommodated as well. And so we have concerns. We have some experience in administering in this area, and so we would like to continue the conversations about how to address this issue and look forward to doing so as soon as you're ready to have those conversations. I think we are seeking some meetings in the next few days to continue talking about this market and how to best get at this part of the marketplace and keep it in parity with other parts of the marketplace. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, does the department know what the tax is on a gallon of this material that's coming into the state
that's
currently?
Coming in. If you might allow me, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to is Dan. Mr. Cummings can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so a gallon of e-juice can go anywhere from $200 to $500. So then that's 95% of that as that comes in. But when that comes in at the manufacturer level, so before it becomes diluted, before it becomes packaged into smaller canisters, that is where the tax is imposed. So the tax on a closed system is imposed at the distributor level after it's been packaged and it's been put in capsules and other types of things. The tax on the open systems is taxed right when this very diluted, non-consumable part of nicotine is brought into the state. That's where the 95% is imposed. So by the time that that is diluted into many gallons, the tax imposed, the $200 to $500, is comes out to be a very small amount of money per vial that is given up.
So in effect,
you still have the four right?
Concentrated.
In effect, what's happening is as the e-juice comes in before it has the nicotine put in, that's not being taxed currently. It's just the nicotine is taxed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so the gallon of the nicotine that comes in is taxed. Yes, that's correct.
That might do 12 or 13 gallons of the
correct.
Juice.
That's right.
So the juice, the 12 gallons, are not being taxed.
Of the solution that is added to the nicotine, no, it is not. Or the flavorings, or the other types of items that are put into this in order to make the finished product.
So they're not paying the tax on the finished product that other manufacturers are paying.
That's right. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Why wouldn't you want to keep that system and the rest?
Well, they do.
Chair Skoy.
Mr. Chair, do you have any idea how that relates to other nicotine products in the state with regard to taxes paid and how much it is per time that they are? And I'm a former smoker. I go on, and while I am a smoker, I just don't smoke now. How much does it cost to use that in relationship to what it would cost to be other tobacco products?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are still working. Part of the challenge in trying to do this is to figure out the administrability. But as it relates to the amount of tax, so it is current with other types of taxes or the same as other types of taxes, we're still trying to do that analysis to try and figure out what is an industry standard for 1 milliliter and how many packs that may, give out. And what would that mean if it were taxed the same through it? I can tell you that it would likely be more than 30 cents per milliliter, though.
Questions from members on the tobacco provisions?
Anything else from the department?
Not this time.
Okay, thank you. And your comments are well taken. I think we need to have several members meet with department folks bring some equity to the situation. Item next, New Markets Credit. Who would be handling that? Mr. Michael or Clayman or Manzi or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Michael. Mr. Chairman, the New Markets Credit provision is on pages 30 to 35 of the side-by-side. What this does is to adopt a state new markets credit that follows the structure and many of the qualification rules of the federal new markets credit. And essentially the way the new markets credit works is that there are these what are called CDEs, community development entities, which are typically nonprofit entities, but they may be for-profit entities that effectively act as financial intermediaries to distribute these credits. And the way it works at the federal level is they apply to the Treasury Department for credit certificates. In Minnesota, they would apply to the Department of Employment and Economic Economic Development for credit certificates that enable them to then in turn sell or transfer those credit certificates to investors, which would typically be insurance companies because they can claim this credit against their insurance premium tax, or it could be a C corporation because they can also under the House bill claim it against the corporate franchise tax. So the CDEs would apply to and get from Deed these credit certificates. They would then transfer them to the investors, use the money that they get from the investing insurance companies to invest in qualified, active, low-income community businesses. And those businesses then would use that money to typically expand their business. And under the House bill, unlike the federal credit is very expansive in the kinds of businesses that it covers. This proposed Minnesota credit is much more restrictive in that it's limited to the types of businesses that qualify for the angel investment credit, manufacturers, so any kind of manufacturer, any kind of business that's in the mining industry or in the forest products industry. So that's the universe of these qualified, active, low-income community businesses. The qualified, active, low-income community businesses also have to be in areas that the federal government has designated as target areas. And I know at the House hearing they handed out maps that showed parts of the state that qualify. It's a very large portion of the state that qualifies. Most rural areas would qualify. And in the urban areas, it tends to be the center cities. The more affluent suburbs obviously do not qualify. So the very simple mechanism is that money that comes from the insurance company to the CDE would then get invested in the low-income business. And in return for that, there would be an obligation to either pay dividends or interest back to the CDE so that the money gets back to the investor. The credit works. It's a 39% credit. That's a funny rate, but that's the same rate that the federal government uses, and it's available to the investor over a 7-year period. The first 2 years, there's no credit. Then the next 4 years, there's an 8% credit, and then in the last year, there's a 7% credit. So essentially, that's the way the mechanism works. It's a way to sort of target investment from insurance companies and C corporations into these businesses that are located in targeted areas in the state, and for investing in high tech, manufacturing, mining, and forest products.
Thank you. Questions for members on the new markets credit? Chair Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I see that in looking at the spreadsheet, it's a January 27 application date. And so there's no cost indicated. So what is the anticipated cost in the out years? I mean, what's the tails look like on this?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the revenue impact would be outside the budget forecast. The projected revenue impact would be $69 million. In years outside of the budget window.
Chair Rest.
69. Senator Rest, 69.
Per year? Is that per biennium or per year?
That is over after fiscal 19 through, I believe, fiscal 21, the revenue impact over those years.
Chair Rest.
That's it. Thank you. I need
Chair Skoy.
Thank you. And Mr. Michaels. So there's a 39% federal credit. How does the state credit interact with the federal credit? Is it just on top of each other, or how does that?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, the assumption is that the businesses that get the state credit would not get the federal credit, so these would typically be there's nothing that prohibits that, but I think the general expectation is that they would not be stacked on top of each other. The whole notion with this is that you're supposed to make a but-for finding so that you don't give them money unless they actually need it. There have been studies of the federal credit that have sort of said, well, by the GAO, we can't really evaluate how effective that is. Just to clarify the fiscal effect, the bill authorizes $250 million in credits. If you apply the 39% rate to that, you'll get a $97.5 million cost. I think the assumption is that there would never in a 4-year window be more than the $69 million that Ms. Templin mentioned, but the total exposure is slightly larger than that $69
million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Michael. So I've actually got some information on this, and I'm trying to follow how the flow of the money works. And so you've got the investor, the insurance company, and they put $10 million into a community development entity. And that entity puts the $10 million into the low-income community business. So there's $10 million flowing into the community to do these to good deeds. The investor gets $3.9 million, I'm assuming, 39% of credit. And then over the 7 years that the low-end community businesses pay back the $10 million, that also goes back to the investor then? So that That's how that works.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoie, that, you know, that's going to be subject to negotiation, and I think the conventional wisdom is that the insurance company, which would be the typical investor in this structure, would be looking for a market rate return. And so, yes, and sometimes these are done with a more complex structure where there's outside borrowing on top of it that complicates matters even more. But I think the notion is that the dividends are the interest that's paid by the business that back through the CDE to the insurance company when combined with the tax credit would provide them with a rate of return that's competitive with their other portfolio investments. So I think and this is what is proven out at the federal level, is that a bunch of these have sort of forgivable loans, or the dividends they pay, you know, is much lower than the alternative financing that they would get because the credit offsets part of that. So I don't think if the CDE is doing its job, the insurance company does not get a windfall of getting both the 39% credit plus all of its money back on a market rate kind of basis. But again, that's sort of up to the CDE to do a good job of sort of figuring out how much it is that the investor insurance company really needs to induce them to invest in this venture.
Ms. Templin, to the Scoie question.
Mr. Chair, just to correct the record about the revenue impact, I did find my revenue estimate on this. And Mr. Michael is correct. It is 39% on $250 million. So the total revenue impact would be $97.5 million. And the revenue estimate that we received from the Department of Revenue shows that there would be a $20 million revenue impact from fiscal year 20 to fiscal year 2023 and a $17.5 million revenue impact in fiscal 24 for a combined total revenue impact over those years of $97.5 million.
Senator Scoie?
Well, I think I probably have enough here. And the phasing is a little issue. I'm not exactly sure. I don't understand why we don't just give a grant to the community development entity and have them go do good things. I haven't figured out exactly the mechanism here for adding to what that would accomplish. But I think that will be fine for this evening.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some of the questions were answered, but I still have a few more. And one of them was, so you said the CDE, if they're doing their job, the money and the credit would go to the investor, and I'll be up front, and Senator Schmidt and I had companion bills here. We were still kind of working through some of the language, and there's still questions. And one of them was, there's no reports in here. So how do we, or at least I couldn't find, are we required to, you know, this is a lot of money. And so lots of times we give money, and we don't always, we find out, you know, a few years later, oh, it's not really doing what we wanted it to do, and nobody bothers to come and tell us it's really not doing what we wanted it to do. So is there reporting in here of where they could come back to either Deed or the tax committee or somebody to say, this is what it's doing, this is the amount we're going through, and then to what you were saying, reports so that we know that the CDEs are doing what they're supposed to do and it's not a huge windfall for other people, but then also so because as things get more complex, it gets harder to be a little more transparent. And so the concern is that, again, it's the but-for. They couldn't get any other investment or they couldn't get any other equity and expand. And so we want to also make sure that, you know, there might be, and, you know, I've worked in the inner city where we had some foreclosure issues where you had a lot of people that were getting investors were targeting, and these people qualified for normal rates, but they were given subprime rates and huge, you know, their payments ballooned, and they went into foreclosure and forfeiture and everything. So is there some assurance as these get more complex that there's transparency so we can make sure that the people that are getting the money are actually getting, you know, not getting hit with, you know, really big rates and balloon payments and all sorts of stuff? So is there transparency in reports that they would have to send back to somebody?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, there is some alternative versions of this have had reports to the legislature. The version that's in the House tax bill does not have a report to the legislature. I think the assumption is that Deed would do some of that. You may, if you adopt this, you may want to think about some reporting requirement, maybe similar to what was done for the Angel Credit, to evaluate it after a few years. And I think with the federal credit, the notion all along is that in terms of approving the CDE, that the reliance is, again, all on the quality of the CDEs, that they're the ones that will make sure that, you know, those loan terms for these qualified low-income businesses are sort of fair and serve the purpose that they're intended to. There are some protections in here in that the only CDEs that can get the state credit are ones that the Treasury Department has actually approved to get the federal credit. So there will be some of that screening that's involved. But, you know, whether or not you want to put more restrictions on them to make sure about some of those things, that would be, you know, something that you might want to look at.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. And then to follow up on the, because I didn't see a definition and I assumed it was in federal, of what is a low-income community. I know we had the discussion of, and I've seen the map where it's all over the state, and I think in, again, I don't remember which bill and which version, there was something so that there was a balance. Again, with the Angel Investment Credit, we have a balance to make sure that some of it is going into greater Minnesota. Here, if you're just limiting it to manufacturing, mining, or high-tech, and forestry, I'm assuming some of the mining and forestry will be in greater Minnesota. But, I mean, that was just kind of a question that I had to make sure that it gets spread around on for this, because I know in some of the other, not necessarily in the New Market Tax Credits, but in some of the others, again, the money wasn't going where we thought it was going, and Job B and some other stuff, so again, just want to make sure that it is targeted, because I do think we have a lot of communities across the state where could really use an infusion of cash and some of the businesses to help them grow. And then on page 135, what does line 135.25, the credit does not affect the calculation of police and fire aid under this section.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, one of the ways that police and fire pensions are funded is by dedicating, it used to be that way, that money from the insurance premiums tax on fire insurance for the fire pensions and on auto insurance for police pensions. They're paid to the local units of government to essentially fund those pension funds. That's done, and obviously any time you have a dedicated revenue source like that, the concern is, gee, if you take revenue away by paying tax credits, that will affect the funding of those pensions. That the legislature faced that a few years ago and said we're not going to actually base it on the actual revenue that's paid, but rather based on the premiums that they report. And so this is sort of a belt and suspenders provision that says no matter whether all of the insurance premium tax goes away because of these tax credits, we're still out of the general fund going to pay police and fire aid to those cities for their pensions.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I think that's it.
Any further questions for members on these provisions, New Markets Credit? If not, we will go to the
department. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We appreciate the discussion about the cost, because they do show up outside of the forecast window, and so it's important to recognize the cost of this program. There's a couple of issues I'd like to just address briefly about the eligible investors. With respect to this program, it seems that it is limited to insurance companies. And although that provision is in there, that limitation, it also seems to be aiming at the type of investment and development of in industries that also could be covered by the Angel Investor Tax Credit, so an existing program that the state of Minnesota already has invested in. And so it may seem productive to consider whether that's a place where this these resources could be dedicated. The other issue is that this is significantly different from the federal program, and wherever there is a federal program, as you know, the department always prefers federal conformity because it is easiest for taxpayers who understand a federal program to take advantage of it at state level. So an alternative you might also consider is mirroring the federal program, and that would also allow the federal dollars to sort of supplement the state dollars that are coming into the state. And that direct state investment in CDEs may be an alternative way to achieve the results that you are looking for with this credit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Michael, we have mentioned several times insurance companies, but we have the Cretia language and we have the Albright language. Didn't we do kind of a merger there and we included insurance companies and banks?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I get the bills mixed up. I think the Cretia bill originally was insurance companies only, and then there was an amendment in the tax committee that expanded it to C corporations. So it would also, this credit would also be available to banks and other kinds. Any C corp could claim the credit too.
It's banks that were C corps.
Right. I think the promoters of this generally consider insurance companies to be the prime market for it, and the reason for that is because they have such predictable liability, since that insurance premiums tax, as you know, so long as you keep selling insurance, you owe the tax, whereas with C corps, if you're not profitable, you don't have tax liability to use the credit, and so the discount that the investors are willing to pay for the uncertainty over a 7-year period whether they're going to get the credit is going to be lower with an insurance company than it will be with a bank or some other kind of public corporation that owes corporate franchise tax.
Well, Mr. Michael, I'm going to keep selling, so it should work. Okay, other questions for members on the New Markets Provision Department? Okay. Let's go on to the next one, reciprocity. And this is, I will speak a little bit to this. This is a David's-Pulowski bill in the House. I believe it, maybe a Miller or Reinert or Reinert Miller over in the Senate. And members, what's happening is for quite some time we had an agreement. We currently have reciprocity agreements with North Dakota and Michigan. For many, many years, we had an agreement with Wisconsin. That agreement was dropped, I believe, in 2009. Maybe I'll just go to Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael, I'll have a few more comments on this, but kind of describe what the provisions do for the reciprocity between, and this is Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, the past agreement with Wisconsin was terminated in 2010. And this provision is intended, I think, to move the states towards entering a new agreement. It makes two changes to the current law with regard to the commissioner's authority to enter into a reciprocity agreement. So that's the first thing to remember, is that the commissioner has the authority to enter into an agreement with Wisconsin at any time without any action on the part of the legislature. The sort of main sticking point with Wisconsin has been as to what the size of the compensating payments would be from Wisconsin to Minnesota, principally as to whether or not Wisconsin would be allowed to deduct the full cost of the revenue that it foregoes by not taxing Minnesota residents because of the way their credit for taxes paid to other states works. So there's a gap between what Wisconsin would like to pay us and what we would like to accept. And this language comes out and says that we will accept what Wisconsin is willing to pay us. So that's sort of what the language is intended to do. It also takes into account the effect of refundable credits paid by Minnesota to not just Wisconsin residents who work in Minnesota, but also in residents of other states who work in Minnesota, by picking up the provision that was in, I believe, the governor's bill to disallow the working family credit for non-residents. I think that termination of the reciprocity agreement in 2010 drew attention to how much Minnesota was paying to full-year non-residents in that refundable credit. And we had thought at one point that most of that was going to Wisconsin residents, but there's actually a large amount that's going to full-year non-residents of states other than Wisconsin as well. So the House sort of has those two provisions as a package intended to move towards resuming the reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin.
And just a bit more history. In 2011, the governor signed the tax bill that had provisions to reinstate reciprocity. Commissioner Franz at the time worked very, very hard, and the governor did, to try and get that put back together. It didn't work at that time, and people have said, this is a big deal in my area, and I'll let you know why in a little bit here, but they were trying to place blame on somebody, so they tried to blame the governor and Commissioner France for not getting it done, and I would stop them right there and say, no, that's not the case at all. They worked very hard to get this done. It was kind of the other side of the river that we were having some problems with. And that being said, then Chairlain Chesky was so gracious last year in the 14 tax bill to put reciprocity provisions in again and actually put some money on the bottom line to try and get this thing done. Commissioner Franz and Governor Dayton, again, worked very hard, and when it comes up at election time, you know, you think you get stuff on vaping? This is what I get it on. And I'll explain why in a second here. So, again, they're saying, well, Governor Dayton didn't get it done, Commissioner Franz didn't get it done. I go, and right in the press, I'd say, no. I'd say, that's not the case. The issue is on the other side of the river. They did everything. Franz worked very hard, and folks in the department were very hard to try and put this together. Didn't get done, not because of any lack of effort on their part. So that brings us to today, and so we have provisions in again here to try and make it so that Commissioner Bowerly could talk to Secretary Chandler in Wisconsin, her counterpart over there, and get this done. And of course, the problem is our tax rates. No, help me out here, Commissioner. Our tax rates are higher, but their marginal tax rates are higher, what creates a bit of the problem here. So what we're trying to do here, and this is very, very bipartisan because it goes from southeastern Minnesota, it goes right up to Lake Superior, basically. But Houston County is one of the counties I represent, and it's 20,000 wonderful souls in Houston County. But Houston County gets negatively impacted worse than any county in the state of Minnesota because of not having tax reciprocity. I understand why Governor Plenty let it go back then. There were problems, again, on the other side of the river, and let it go. Basically, we weren't getting paid on a timely basis is what it happened. We had some budget issues at the time. So Houston County, 20,000 wonderful souls, gets hit harder than any other county in the state of Minnesota, including because... And the reason is because the regional center is on the other side of the river, whereas you work your way up the river, the regional center for Hudson would be Minneapolis-St. Paul, Superior is Duluth, and so here you have Houston County with just 20,000 folks really being negatively impacted on this. So we go to questions from members, and then we'll go to the department with their thoughts. We've talked a lot about this issue. Chair Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding, and I don't remember all the details, that part of the problem for Wisconsin is not Minnesota. The problem for Wisconsin is coming up with reciprocity with Illinois, in which they would be really, really negatively impacted. And so if they went with a reciprocity program with Minnesota, where they would arguably gain some dollars if they felt forced to do that with Illinois, there would be a huge loss to them. So they, you know, say, well, let's just forget the whole thing, and so they become very unwilling to negotiate a reciprocity agreement. You were shaking your head. Obviously, you understand what a problem Illinois is for the state of Wisconsin with regard to reciprocity, right?
That is another factor that they're very concerned about.
Yeah.
Chair Skoy.
Ms. Manzi, I listened to you, and I didn't quite catch what you were doing with regard to the working family credit. I understand that, from my understanding, is we're carrying revenue generated by the elimination of Wisconsin being able to collect Minnesota's working family credit. If we achieve reciprocity, I understood that the ability to score that money goes away, and so we have to not only lose the $10 million in revenue that we're currently carrying on the spreadsheet for eliminating the Wisconsin ability to collect Minnesota's working family credit, but we're also going to have a $12 million cost for achieving the reciprocity that the chair has been advocating. Am I getting that close, or did I misunderstand some of what you said there?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, you are close, but the interesting part that we actually sent a proposal to the Department of Revenue for an estimate on just those two pieces alone in order to sort of find out how much of that working family credit disallowance for non-residents was due to not having reciprocity. Because once you have reciprocity, you don't save that $10 million anymore. And the estimate came back showing that of that $10.3 million in the 16-17 biennium, $6 million of it relates to Wisconsin residents, and the rest of it relates to people who live in other states. So when you do those two provisions, you still save some money, which in the view of the House sort of came to our attention because of the lapse or the termination of the reciprocity agreement. So we had packaged those together at one point to try to get at a way to reduce the revenue impact of going back to reciprocity.
So, Ms. Manzi, I think the line is 37. Mm-hmm. So is that the impact of both of these provisions bundled together?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I think that is probably just the impact of the reciprocity, and then the working family credit item is on a separate line.
Mr. Chair, the working family credit lines are on page 2, lines 29 and 30. You can see the House and the Senate provisions kind of together. We put those two lines together. With the reciprocity in effect and the disallowance of the working family credit, the revenue gain is $4.3 million in the 16-17 biennium compared to the Senate and the governor. The revenue gain is projected to be $10.3 million with the disallowance of the working family credit with no reciprocity in effect.
So the net is negative $8.4 million with the two House proposals, and the governor's a positive $10.6 million.
Mm-hmm. Or excuse me, Ms. Templin.
It's a combination of line 30s and 37.
Yes. If you packaged the reciprocity and the disallowance of the working family credit with reciprocity in effect, the cost of the or the revenue reduction for the reciprocity would be $8.4 million over the in the 16-17 biennium.
Chair
Skoy.
That's the net revenue loss from in the House version of
yes,
the provision. Correct.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. Chair Skoy. Nope, that's what I was
And members, on this issue, as I said last year, Chair Lincheski put the provisions in the omnibus tax bill. We were sitting here a year ago and put that in. And what I'm doing was the original bill that I introduced not only up the ante as far as dollars to try and get this deal closed. But it also said that the House and Senate, the legislature, would take over the negotiations and run the whole thing. I was just a little too excited at that point. And so just so members know, it is the executive branch that would be administering this and cutting the deal. So I did back off on that a little bit. So with that, let's go to the department, then we'll go back to any member questions, then we'll proceed. To the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And we absolutely understand the concerns of Minnesotans who are in this situation. And we appreciate your work, Mr. Chairman, to work with us on the language. We do think it's important that the best interests in Minnesota remain the focal point for any agreement that we could reach with Wisconsin. And as you noted, last session, Minnesota offered basically $1 million to Wisconsin to offset the net revenue losses as a result of the reciprocity agreement. And unfortunately, Wisconsin responded by reiterating their previously held position, and we're not able to engage in any meaningful dialogue with Minnesota. But we do appreciate the changes that you made, and we would continue to raise concerns about the loss to Minnesota as a result of the effective tax rates that are higher in Wisconsin. We also would want to note that there are, every state has a different budget forecast. Minnesota's is actually looking quite good. Our state to the east does not have as rosy of outlook. And one of the issues that the prior administration, the Governor Pawlenty, ultimately canceled the agreement over was the delay in payments. And so that would be an issue that we would have to consider as we consider whether it's in the best interest of Minnesota to enter any agreement. And I just would note that press reports indicate that already this year Wisconsin has announced that it is delaying debt service payments due to its budget problems. So there would be no guarantee that even if we were to be able to strike an agreement, that Wisconsin would be able to make those payments on time. And at that point, Minnesota is in a debtor position to Wisconsin, and our general fund is at issue at that point. And because it's not just the amount that you see at issue on the spreadsheet, that's the difference in the net revenue loss that Minnesota would face in a reciprocity agreement. But the payments themselves are much larger, totaling over $100 million a year. And so that would be actually what's at risk with an agreement. So we would want to make sure that any deal could be fair to Minnesota and put the best interests of Minnesota at stake. And it is simply the fact, as you note, Mr. Chairman, that more Wisconsinites do work in Minnesota, although that is geographically dispersed, and it does vary county by county. And as a result of that, fewer people would pay taxes in Minnesota, and that's why Wisconsin would wind up needing to cut us a very large check. So we appreciate the changes that you've made thus far. We would like to continue to be in discussion about what the right approach is for reciprocity for Minnesota going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions for members? Okay, we'll go to item next. Thank you, Commissioner. Border Cities. Who's that, Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael? Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the border city provisions are on page 35 of the side-by-side. What the House bill does on the existing border city provision is to essentially provide a permanent statutory appropriation of $1 million per year for this program that the cities could allocate between either of the basic border city programs. The Senate has an identical appropriation amount, but it's a one-time appropriation for the 16-17 biennium that follows the pattern that's generally been done in the past. In addition, the House bill has a designates the city of Taylor's Falls as qualifying for border city development powers and provides a one-time $100,000 allocation to Taylor's Falls for that purpose. This is just the development zone part of the powers, which is the portion that's dedicated to attracting new business and new investment, not the basic enterprise zone provision that's allowed to be given to existing businesses.
Questions for members?
Maybe, Ms. Vice Chair Barry, maybe a few comments on Taylor's Falls for the Senate.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So Taylor's Falls is in Chisago County, right outside the seven-county metro area. And generally speaking, from a county perspective, they have many of the same issues that we face on the western side of the state. Growing up in a town, Brandon, South Dakota, right across the border, I'm well familiar with a lot of the issues that the western side of Minnesota has with businesses that seem to attract themselves to North Dakota or South Dakota. But now that I represent Chisago County, some of those same issues apply. Taylor's Falls is literally right on the border, right on the St. Croix River. Small town, bigger town across the river, St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. Larger economic development opportunities exist. The provisions in the bill here have been authored by three different reps over the past 10-year period on a bipartisan basis. They've gotten to various levels of the process, but as of yet have not been implemented into law. Taylor's Falls right now has a business park. It's currently vacant. They've had it open for a couple years now. They'd like to attract business from Wisconsin. They'd like to get some of those businesses back that have moved over, especially related to the Osceola Industrial Park, which I mentioned in my opening comments a week ago. I don't know this to be a fact, although I have looked and generally verified it, but our former Chisago County Economic Development Manager, Chris Ng, said that about 17 of the 20 businesses in the Osceola Industrial Park are from Minnesota or have strong Minnesota ties. And, you know, a lot of reasons people go over there, but we would like to get them back. North Branch is not included in this, but they also have a industrial park that currently is, it's not empty, but it does house their county health and human services department. But it is another place where we'd like to attract business. And so we'd like $100,000. And it would be, I would consider it a grant to a local economic development entity, which might be, I think, a good way to allow the locals to do with it what they can to attract business. And I'd be happy to answer more questions about that.
Questions for members? Chair Squire?
Chair, not questioning intent or anything. I'm just curious, is this a one-time, or are you thinking there would be additional legislative requests?
Chair Barrett?
Well, the language of the bill is one time. Obviously, if something works, we'd like to do more of it. If it doesn't work, then why bother? Certainly we want it to work. That remains to be seen whether it will or not.
It's my intent that tax reciprocity will come back to this committee every year.
How are we going to get that done, Mr. Chair?
We'll work on it. Chair Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The western border cities use the border city aid, as I recall, to reduce business taxes. Is that correct? Do I recall that correctly?
Chair Skoy.
Senator Rest, they can use them to reduce property sales or income taxes.
And so,
Chair Rest.
I do recall that. So, Representative Barrett, which of those do you think would have the greatest impact if Taylor's Falls was to get $100,000? I'm not, you know, asking you to tell me what the city would do, but what I'm just asking your opinion of what would be the greatest impact if you were asked to make a recommendation the city of Taylor's Falls for how they would use that $100,000.
Sure,
Chair Barrett.
I appreciate the question, Chair Rest. You know, it would depend on the actual company that they're negotiating with. I think really to answer that question accurately, I think property taxes, and I believe, you know, this applies to at least two sections in law, which I don't have memorized, 469.1732 and 469.1734, and I believe an additional one, but I believe property taxes are in there.
In terms of how they can
use it. Yeah, so it really would depend on the business they're trying to attract to Taylor's Falls.
Senator Rush.
That's it, thank you.
Other questions from Vice Chair Barrett?
Yeah, just one more thing. I think, you know, as it relates to where we're located, Chisago County in general and Taylor's Falls, 60% of the people who work, 60% of the residents of Chisago County work in the Twin Cities. They have a pretty long commute. And I think as you look at you know, where they're going to the seven-county area. They're getting paid pretty well to work down here, but they are traveling 50 miles or more. All that gas that they're using out of their car every day. I mean, what we'd like is to have a robust economic development system in our county so that we can maybe save some gas and do good things for the environment and allow people to spend more time with their family.
That would reduce the gas costs.
Yeah, but we'll make up for
Chair Scott.
We're going to make up for
yeah.
that.
There's a proposal out there to make up for that, Mr. Chair.
I heard
Chair.
About that. Yeah.
I go up there to pick the berries. So
okay, questions
more.
For members, and then let's go to the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as it relates to the border cities aid, Commissioner Franz did go up to Moorhead last year. To talk about many of the issues that are going on in the border. There was a study that was done and presented to the legislature earlier this year. So, you know, border cities is something that the Department of Revenue is certainly thinking a lot about. As it relates to the Taylor's Falls on the Wisconsin border, the, you know, when the border cities was originally put in, it was put in after the ongoing funding for border cities was put in. That was put in after a study that was done about competitiveness on the North Dakota border. So, you know, I realize that this is a one-time allocation, but as you're thinking about ongoing allocations, it might be good to think about having a study of border issues if this is going to be expanded beyond the North Dakota border, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions from members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess more just a comment. I think, you know, when you're talking about the border tax issues and with border cities, I know there's also kind of a bipartisan effort kind of on just the building codes and some other things that some of these border cities are dealing with and kind of that trying to bring what's North Dakota, what they're building in Fargo or trying to encourage development in Moorhead. I know that I think Representative Lean from up in that neck of the woods and Representative Keel and Fabian are all working on some of those border portions. So it is definitely kind of a multi-pronged approach, I think, that they're taking with this. So,
other questions from members on this provision? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the, and again, I pulled up the original bill, not, I didn't look in here, but it says that, you know, Taylor Falls determines that the tax reduction necessary to enable the business to expand. Would that be by ordinance or just the economic development person sign off on it, or did you get into that detail of how you wanted to?
Vice Chair Barrett or Mr. Michael, to that point, to the senator's point.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, essentially what the provision does is to follow the standard that's in the general law for the cities along the western border. So they'd need to make, the city would need to make a finding before it allocated money that it was necessary to actually cause the investment to occur. Since this portion of the program is limited to new investments and new businesses or expansions.
Senator Dietrich?
Thank you.
Okay, item next, Department of Revenue Bill provisions. Some differences. This would be the, I believe, policy and technical bill. Okay, so that's Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, basically what we did was went through the bill that's on the House floor and the Senate provisions and listed the differences between them. And we know from having worked with the department that the department also has another air flight property tax provision that they missed that they would like to include in this about with regard to the gross takeoff weight. So that's not listed here, but otherwise these six items are cases where there are slight language differences. None of them rise to the level of policy matters. But so, for example, on the notification of certificates of rent paid, there's a minor difference between the bill that's on the House floor and the bill that's in the Senate omnibus tax bill. Similarly, on the estate tax, where there are property reclassifications, the bill, I believe that's on the House floor, breaks it into lettered clauses, whereas the Senate bill does not. So those are the kind of differences that we're talking about. Now, the one thing to keep in mind, because the Senate, there are two provisions, because the Senate is making Sustainable Forest Incentive Act changes, that they pulled those provisions out of the department's bill. Similarly, because of the electric utility restructuring, when we passed the unsessioned bill last year, we inadvertently repealed one of the personal property tax exemptions for one of these new utility plants. Because the Senate's going to a whole new structure for taxing those plants, they don't revive it. The House bill does revive it. Similarly, the House, at the request of Representative Simonson, made a change in the revenue recapture provision where you take into account the spouse's income to clarify that the, if the spouses are separated, that then the spouse's income is not taken into account. That is not in the Senate bill. And then the House, in passing the policy and technical bill, inadvertently dropped a section in our amendment, and that obviously is another difference. So all of those things, I don't know if you want to, you know, just direct the staff to work with the department to work these things out, or how you want to handle that.
Chair Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I thought Mr. Michael said that the Senate did not have the new recapture provision. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, if I said that, I was wrong. Basically, both bills have that provision. The House clarified that if the spouse is separated from the spouse who has the debt, that separated spouse's income would not be taken into account. Right. Whereas the Senate bill is the original department language, which just says if they're domiciled in the same home, that then their incomes are taken into account.
So, Mr. Chairman, so that it is really making it quite clear in the provision that's in the House, on the House floor, what we mean by that provision. Is that correct?
Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, it addresses.
Is that a legal, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michael, is that a legal separation that's determinative, or if the Senate bill is just, okay, you're living apart, but is what would determine being separated?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I believe you would need to have a separation agreement. So what the Senate bill has in it is it has a domicile test, which is an intent test. So if you intend to be domiciled with your spouse, then the income counts. There was some concern on the House side that would be difficult to administer. And so the actual language that's in the House bill goes back to what it was back in the 1980s, which was the standard that was used back then, when I'm not sure how the language actually got dropped, but that's what we discovered.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that we ask both staffs to look at that provision, working with the commissioner staff, to make sure we get it, that the language reflects the intent of what we're trying to accomplish, particularly trying to protect a spouse that did not contribute to the problem.
And with that, the question was asked, on these six provisions, should we have both staffs work together and maybe come up with something that's reasonable and present that to us?
Yes.
Would that be
Chair's court.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Pollack, are you in agreement with Mr. Michaels that these are stylistic changes and you guys can work out the differences?
Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, yes, and I can speak to the landlord submission of electronic CRPs and the estate property tax reclassifications. Perhaps Mr. Sylvia could speak on the SFIA and the personal property tax exemption language.
Here's
well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sylvia, I think until we resolve SFIA and electrical generation, we don't need to be concerned about those two provisions okay. yet.
It's a CRP.
No, it's not CRP. Oh, up there, yeah. Oh, sure. Did I? Okay. I thought he was talking about SFIA.
So, Chair Skoy, we're looking at working on the first and second items on the first page on the back, working on
the last two.
Last two.
Yep.
Is that acceptable, committee member? Because the other two are part of a bigger issue that we'll need to discuss further. Okay, so let's go ahead with that now. Going to, and we'll come back to member questions, but in going to the department, these are the things that were kind of similar. If you can kind of give us a broader overview of the policy technical corrections bills that we have here, a little broader. I know that the Senate has it in their bill. We have them as separate bills, but kind of for the conference committee, you can let us know, kind of walk through the bills if you would. Maybe Mr. Cummings?
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can do a high-level overview. Mr. Chair and members, the policy and technical bills, all the provisions in these bills are brought forward in a process throughout the interim to bring forward comments from staff as it relates to the existing tax code. They're worked through the fall and then sent out at the beginning of session usually to members of the community to talk about the bills. Maybe it might be helpful, Mr. Chair, to touch on some points that sparked controversy this year and that may or may not be in these bills. I think that might be the best place to talk through it. There was one provision that dealt with the commissioner's orders dates and some of the dates that had been brought forth. There was some concerns that had been brought forth by the chamber and the business partnership related to how that date is specified. So we worked with the chamber and the business partnership to ensure that the notice for the dates would not be put on an order form before they actually were sent. So we wanted to ensure that the notice date gave them the complete 60 days in order for them to have their appeal rights. So that was something that we had worked on with the Chamber and the Business Partnership. That language is included in both approaches. So that bit of controversy had been resolved. There was also some questions that had been brought up by the multi-housing group related to the certificate of rent paid provision. We had worked with them to develop language and develop a common understanding on how we would move forward. So the language outside of just some formatting is the same in both bills, and it is language that was that the multi-housing advocates did agree upon. Mr. Chair, one of the provisions that is not in this bill that is found in another article of the Senate bill is the provision relating to local lodging taxes. That was part of the policy, the technical bill as presented to both bodies. That provision was removed by both the House and the Senate at the time of the hearing, and then there was another hearing held by the Senate for Senator Wicklund's bill. Senator Wicklund's bill was put into the Senate bill, and it was discussed as a separate provision in another article. So I think in any motion that would be moved forward, the local lodging tax provision would be set aside for a discussion that is separate from the policy and technical bill, but that was removed from both policy and technical bill approaches. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, this is a collection of edits from the department to the tax code that we believe help it work better, help function better, and hopefully are as non-controversial as possible. I'd be more than happy to answer any specific questions related to the provisions. I can walk through the sections of the bill or have staff walk through sections of the bill if you might find that to be important. But otherwise, we look forward to working with House and Senate staff to develop an amendment that might be pleasing to this conference committee.
Well, let's see, Mr. Cummings, this issue is between us and adjourning. So maybe what we can do is have members ask questions if they have questions about the tech. And Mr. Cummings, I really want to thank you and Commissioner Bowerly for the work you did on this, too. In the past, these have always been kind of peace in the valley type of things. And I think you got us there. On the House side, we didn't have the provision on the lodging tax thing, but I agree that should probably be discussed separately. So thank you for making this work for the Chamber and the partnership, the housing folks. I think you've done a great job on that. So with that, we'll go to questions from members on the DOR bill provisions. If there are no questions on this, we've gone through the House provisions that we had here today. I would turn it over to Chair Skoy for an announcement for tomorrow's meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we will be getting, if it's not already, it's not to you now, you'll be getting this shortly, but the Senate has a number of provisions we're going to work off tomorrow. I think we have a cigarette smuggling provision, Tofty housing provision, a repeal of the ag containment facility. There is a definition of conservation reserve program land, a levy for historical society, a grant to St. Louis County, changes to seasonal rec. Senator Gazelka has an issue with regard to property tax payment postmark. We have the reserve and the study date language, Senator Rest airport fuel change, and then our public finance article that we would like to go through tomorrow.
That sounds very good. Anything else from members or from the department for the good of the order? Senator Dietzick?
Mr. Chair, last Friday I talked about the tax forfeited properties sale agreement. I believe Rep. Dzkrowski and Senator Rust were authors of the bill. I actually have the amendment. If I want to, we can just pass it out if you want. It's just to have the language fixed, and I will remind you. I have it here.
Senator Skoy?
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Dietzick's amendment, I think that because this is something that she would like to fix in the Senate language,
or Senator Dietzick.
Well, you should fix it in the Senate language, and then we'll see if they're going to adopt it or not.
I think that would make more sense because, as we said at the beginning of the meeting, that there are things we need to work on some provisions so we can at least vote on some point in time. Is this the DTIC? Members, if you would, is this the DTIC provision 713?
Yep.
Okay, keep these in our packets here for tomorrow.
Perfect.
Or sent provisions as well. I think that's better.
Yeah, we'll move this tomorrow. Then.
Perfect.
Sometime tomorrow.
So, Chair Skoy, what are your intentions for
2 o'clock or half an hour? Nope. See, in half an hour after the last body adjourns.
Okay, that sounds good. So, members, half an hour after the last body adjourns. And members, got a couple nights here probably that won't be quite as extensive as they will be later in the week. Hopefully we'll get some numbers and we'll put this together. And I'm certainly looking forward to that. So with that, members and staff, don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.
Talk to
Mr. Chair. Okay. Okay.
I just have kind of my three originals.